À toutes avec un crisse de gros E parce que c'est toujours bien la base d'essayer d'inclure tout le monde. Dans le fond, là, tout ou.
www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a man, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
Hi, and welcome to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's December 23rd, 2022. Today we're hearing from Gita, a teacher and activist living in Toronto. Gita is a founding member of Education Not Incarceration and joins us today to talk about the group's struggle to keep police out of public schools in Toronto. Gita shares why police, even under the friendly name School Resource Officer, don't belong in schools, and provides a timely update to Education Not Incarceration's recent efforts and their collaboration with other activists in Toronto. Enjoy the interview. Okay, Gita, welcome to Prison Radio Show. We're really excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was wondering if you'd like to start by just maybe giving an introduction of yourself.
Sure. My name is Geetha Madden. I'm based out of Toronto, and I'm an educator, a community organizer, also a researcher. And a lot of my work revolves around the intersection between the school system and the criminal justice system, and specifically on issues around the school-to-prison pipeline.
Awesome. Before we go any farther, would you be comfortable just giving us a definition of what the school-to-prison pipeline means?
Yeah, for sure. So the school-to-prison pipeline is all of the ways that young people are pushed out of the school system and into the carceral system. So sometimes it's thought of as this linear pathway, you know, for example, the police, when police arrest students, and that's how they enter the criminal justice system. But a lot of people also think about it as less linear and more of sort of a web of intertwined factors that push students out of the school system, including, you know, all of the racism that they might face or other things that happen in school that disengage them from the school community and push them into all of the networked factors that push students out of schools into the carceral system.
What age do you think students start experiencing factors of the school-to-prison pipeline?
Oh, I think right as soon as they enter the school system. I mean, there are stories from not, you know, even from the past couple of years of very, very young children being handcuffed in schools. There was a young girl, a six-year-old black child in Mississauga that was handcuffed at the wrists and at the ankles and let out of school by a police officer. And there's, you know, the issues that lead to the criminalization of young people, particularly Black, Indigenous, and other racialized students, start right from the first day kids enter the school system in kindergarten.
Yeah. And maybe just for listeners who are learning about this for the first time, do you have any examples of maybe less obvious things than like direct police involvement, but other some of these other networking factors?
Yeah. One of the ways that I like to refer to this that I've picked up in this work is sort of like there's this idea of big P policing, which is the police themselves and other agents of the state enacting sort of like state violence on people, on young people, on their bodies. But then there's also all of these manifestations of small P policing. So just the, for example, ways that students come to feel a sense of belonging or not belonging in the school, the ways that teachers, I mentioned this already, sort of like create that sense of belonging community in their classrooms or don't. The ways that teachers see their students, criminalize students, discipline their students, suspensions and expulsions, the way conflict is dealt with within classrooms and within schools, the school curriculum, how, you know, what are students seeing themselves reflected in what they're being taught? Is it engaging to them? Is it culturally relevant? You know, there are so many ways that students can become disengaged from school because of the school system and the way that it has been structured over all of these decades.
Great. Thanks for explaining that. So it sounds like your work revolves a lot around the kind of pushing back against the school to prison pipeline. And I know that you're a member of this group, Education Not Incarceration. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that group. Give us an introduction, and then maybe we can talk about the timeline and the history of the group's work.
Yeah, for sure. So Education Not Incarceration is a group made up of young people, educators, researchers, parents, other caregivers, journalists, community members, pretty widespread. And we came together in 2016 with the sort of mandate or goal of dismantling the school to prison pipeline. And we came together specifically around a campaign to remove school resource officers from schools in Toronto. I myself had done my master's research on this program, which was a partnership between the Toronto District School Board and the Toronto Catholic District School Board and the Toronto Police Services. And this was a program that had put armed and uniformed police officers on a full-time basis in schools across the city, but particularly in racialized and low-income areas of the city. And when I had done that research, when I was in school, I found out a lot of things about this program. But I also realized at the time that there was a lot of information that was really hidden. It was really hard to find more information about the program, about how it had started, who was funding it, how decisions were being made, et cetera. And I also had found that even though this program started in 2008 in Toronto, that there was a pretty significant resistance to it at the time of its implementation. But that resistance kind of died down, and then the program continued over all of these years. So coming out of that, I pulled together some friends and other organizers around the city, and you know, just tried to we turned into Education Not Incarceration, and we tried to just revive this history of resistance that had existed at the beginning of the program, and sort of start this renewed push to get these police officers and this program out of schools. So we were really actually formed around this specific campaign and pushed really hard. And we actually ended up winning the campaign in November of 2017. And I'm super happy to talk more about that.
Yeah. So I just want to make sure I understand. So starting in 2008, there was the decision to implement school resource officers, which are also called SROs, which is also like a sort of palatable term for armed police, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay.
Into public schools in Toronto. And then in 2016, you and some co-collaborators formed this group to sort of try to push SROs out of the school system.
Yeah, to sort of revive that campaign that had started when they first were implemented in 2008.
Yeah. And can you talk a little bit about what happened sort of between the beginning of ENI in 2016 and this sort of success in 2017?
Yeah. So when we first came together in 2016, we basically created a campaign that involved a bunch of different elements. So one was pushing very directly. You know, this was a partnership program between the police services and the school board. So we understood that if we put pressure on either, like, we had the ability to end the program by pushing putting pressure on either of those two parties to end the program. That, you know, and that was one way of doing it. So we started at the Toronto Police Services Board, raising issues about, we had already collected a number of stories. I myself am a teacher. I had a lot of students that had experienced firsthand policing in schools. I've worked in schools where there were SROs. And so we basically pushed really hard first at the Toronto Police Services Board for the removal of this program, highlighting all of the issues, there's already a history of so much systemic racism within the police service just generally. And so we were highlighting all the ways that those unresolved issues that have existed since the beginning of policing are manifesting within the school system and within schools, and really making schools unsafe places for particular students who are already over-policed in their own neighborhoods. So that, at the Police Services Board, it was very interesting because the first Police Services Board meeting that we went to and made some deputations, it was an item on the agenda that comes up every year just for yearly approval of the SRO program. And we made some deputations and definitely caught them off guard because it had sort of hadn't come up for a number of years. And actually at that first meeting, they almost removed the program right on the spot. They almost voted to do that, but they decided to defer that decision until the next meeting. And then a lot of rallying happened in community on both sides. So by the time the next meeting rolled around, there was a really big contingent of folks that were pushing for the removal, but also the other side, the pro-SRO, pro-policing side, had also mobilized. So that next meeting was a really long, I think it was 8 or 9 hours of deputations from both sides, both pro and against SROs. In the end, we weren't successful on the Police Services Board side. They just weren't going to listen to the concerns of the community and vote to remove their own officers from schools. So we ended up transitioning our efforts over to the school board side of things. We also, at the same time, were mounting a pretty big media campaign. We started to get a lot of media once the issue started to ramp up. And so we had to do a lot of shaping of the public narrative as well around, you know, why police don't belong in schools, because there was quite a lot of just general public support for the program. So there was a sort of media and public narrative campaign that was happening too. And then by the time we shifted over to putting pressure on the school board side of things, we were doing a lot of lobbying of trustees, a lot of public education, but also education of school board administrators, trustees, about exactly what this program was doing, the damage that this program was doing in schools. And then after, you know, just it sort of like things got escalated. We ended up forming sort of a coalition with a number of other organizations around the city, especially once other, you know, parent groups and community groups started to get involved. And in the end, we were able to put enough public pressure through also social media and all of the different ways that you sort of that you could think of to put pressure. And it amounted to, In August of 2017, the TDSB decided to pause the program. No, they actually decided to do a review of the program. And so we were actually like, well, you know, you don't actually have to do a review of the program because we already know, we're already telling you everything you need to know to suspend it. But sure, go ahead, do a review of the program. But we really, what the one thing we asked for at that point was to pause the program during review, because it wouldn't make sense for this review to be happening while there were police officers in schools, and for, you know, students and staff to be interviewed about the program while there was a police officer in the hallway, you know. So we asked for the program to be paused. So the program was paused for a number of months, and that ended up being a really good thing, because we were able to show, hey, this program was paused during the review and nothing bad has happened, you know. But then also at the same time, during the TDSB's review, they found basically everything that community had been saying the whole time. And that led to November 2017, a decision being made by trustees for the permanent removal of the SRO program from TDSB schools. So our pressure was on the TDSB. It still existed in Catholic schools, the Catholic school board. And that has been a bigger fight. But yeah, that was a huge, huge win, because this is the largest public school board in the country. And a number of school boards kind of followed suit in the years following that big win. So now it's just recently been more a matter of protecting the win, now that this has come back onto the table.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for sharing. That is a huge win. And I really want to ask some questions to kind of like help understand a little bit more what created the context for that. Because it can be so hard when we see these like wins towards a more just society to kind of like understand there's so much effort and labor that goes towards making them happen. So I'd love if we could dive in and kind of like pull apart some of the things that were happening there. So just so that listeners have context, I'm wondering if you could describe to us people who were sort of pro keeping the SRO program in schools, what were the claims they were making?
Right. So I think this is really interesting. I'll go into a little bit of the history because it shapes where these arguments were coming from. So actually, can I just give you a little bit of the history of how this program came to be in the first place?
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So just stepping back for a moment, the presence of law enforcement in high schools across North America really expanded in the 90s. The first SRO program that ever existed was in Flint, Michigan in the 50s, but this sort of approach to school discipline, in a sense, really proliferated in the 90s. And this was because there was a broader zero tolerance approach being taken in many sort of arenas in society. So the zero tolerance approach was first an approach to federal drug legislation in the U.S., where there were very strict and severe consequences for even minor transgressions of the law, right? And that has led to our current state of mass incarceration. It is one of the factors that has led to this current state of mass incarceration that we find ourselves in. And so that approach of zero tolerance started to be applied in all of these different areas, including in schools. So zero tolerance in schools, what that looks like is when students break a school rule or misbehave, there's, instead of sort of a progressive approach where the consequence matches the level of the behavior, zero tolerance means the consequence is severe, is punitive. There's no room really for making mistakes. It's just a very, there's zero tolerance really for any misbehavior or breaking of rules. And so when this approach to school discipline was first implemented, it started building out, and a lot of carceral measures and technologies were starting to be implemented in schools, particularly in the U.S. So things like putting police officers in schools, metal detectors, drug sniffing dogs, you know, all of these sort of like very carceral approaches to schools and to school discipline. And then that made its way up here because a lot of policy in the U.S. eventually does make its way up into Canada it Canadianizes in a sense, but made its way up here too. So in Ontario, we enacted, in terms of school discipline, an actual official policy on school discipline called the Safe Schools Act in 2007. But what ended up happening was that the Ontario Human Rights Commission found that the Safe Schools Act was enacted in 2001, my mistake. But the Ontario Human Rights Commission found in 2007 that policy was having a really discriminatory effect and being sort of disproportionately applied on different students, and particularly Black students, Indigenous students, Tamil, Latinx students, and students with disabilities. So that was a time when the school boards had to shift away from this approach to something more progressive, right? Also in 2007, this really big incident happens in Toronto where a young man was killed on TDSB property. And this was the first time that a young person had been killed on TDSB property. So while you have this really big push away, the school boards have to move away because of the Ontario Human Rights Commission and these findings, away from zero tolerance, there's also this huge push to make schools safer and this sort of like moral panic around safety in schools and schools being unsafe and the rise of school violence and all of these things. So the school boards find themselves in this really tricky position of trying to answer to public calls for accountability and to show that they're doing something in schools. And so what ended up happening was that the police services, the chief of police at the time, Bill Blair, approached the school board and said, hey, we can put police officers in schools and that'll really help with this predicament that you find yourself in right now. And the trustees in the school board just agreed. You know, there wasn't even much debate about it. They were like, yes, let's do this. Let's implement this program. And it was implemented right away, just in September of 2008. with very little, well, no community consultation, very little sort of even announcement of what was happening. So that's how we kind of got to the implementation of SROs in schools. And I think it's also important to say that when all of this was happening, all of these big concerns around school safety, there were a couple of reports that were and studies that were commissioned by the province and by the school board about what we can do about school safety. One was called The Roots of Youth Violence. Another was called a School Safety Panel Report. And these reports produced a lot of recommendations, a couple of hundred recommendations about what can actually be done in schools to improve school safety. Not all of the recommendations were amazing, but a lot of them were really good. And importantly, none of them said to implement police officers in schools. But this is what happened, and this is how we ended up with this program in schools across the city in 2008, and in high schools in particular.
Okay. And yeah, thanks for that history. It's really helpful to understand the context. And I just want to make sure, so what you're describing is that you described racialized youth, indigenous youth, youth with disabilities, who we know are already more likely to experience police violence outside of schools. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of like then replicated in terms of their own experiences with SROs in the schools they were attending.
Yes, absolutely. So schools are in so many ways microcosms of the larger society, right? And they don't exist in a vacuum. So a lot of the experiences that kids were already having outside of school, in the streets, in their communities, were now brought into the school, which are supposed to, you know, young people are very vulnerable and need safety. And now you have these kinds of interactions happening in the schools. And there are so many really, really detrimental consequences to this. So some of them include, you know, just the disciplinary consequences of this. So issues that may have otherwise been dealt with by the school administration are now being dealt with by the police, meaning things that might have led to other disciplinary consequences, maybe even including suspension and expulsion, are now becoming matters of the criminal system, right, of the carceral system. And especially when you have school police officers and SROs only in particular schools in the city, it means that in some schools, there are kids exhibiting particular behaviors or doing certain things that are receiving a certain type of consequence. And then in other schools, the consequences are completely different because of the presence of SROs. We also see that the same targeting and over-policing that happens in outside of schools happens within schools too, where you have particular students being targeted by the police within their school spaces, right? It's not sort of like this objective approach by any means, of course. And there's so many studies that also show that in the US, for example, even at the time, there were studies that showed that Black students are way more likely to be arrested in school than white students, that Black students are more likely to be taken into custody from school, that their Black and Latino students in the US are much more likely to have school-related referrals to law enforcement, et cetera, et cetera. So the disciplinary consequences are huge. And then what also happens is there's sort of a culture of fear that that sort of begins to happen in schools when you have police in schools. There were so many students that reported feeling more fear, intimidation, lack of safety in schools, anxiety. There's a study by Carl James, who's a researcher in Toronto at York University, and he was saying that students that he interviewed said that they started to minimize their involvement in school activities just in order to limit contact with officers. And I saw that myself too, because I had students, for example, who played on school sports teams, but then, you know, when a sports team starts to get coached by a police officer, you don't want to show up anymore to play. So there are so many ways, like I was saying before, about that disengagement can happen, and this push out happens is not just directly being arrested. It's even just having to navigate being in the presence of officers. And yeah, and just all of the ways, you know, students were reporting all of these different ways that they feel criminalized in school, even just having the police car outside the school, parked in front of the school every day, is signals to the community that maybe there's always problems at the school when it's just the school resource officer who's permanently stationed there, and the ways that young people feel criminalized just by the presence of officers. And then there's this other really important piece around surveillance. So in a school space, students are taught or are encouraged to trust adults and to go to adults with concerns that they have and confide in adults. And this was definitely happening from police officers. I think one of the really big ways that this program was framed. It was initially implemented because of school safety issues, but it actually, the justification of this program really shifted over time to this idea of relationship building. So this, you know, this program being a vehicle through which young marginalized people could build better relationships with police officers. And, you know, there are so many questions about, you know, like, why is this relationship so strained in the first place? And many of us know the answers to that. But this is sort of like this shift that happened towards relationship building was really damaging, because going back to your earlier question about the arguments for SRO policing, a lot of them are that, oh, the police are there to create better relationships with young people, or, you know, the police might be detrimental outside of the school, but the school resource officer program is different because our SRO is a nice guy and he, you know, coaches this team, or he does presentations, or he really supports kids. So this relationship building sort of narrative really was powerful. It was a powerful move by the police to shift the narrative and to make the program really palatable and justify its presence in a way that was really hard to counter. So that, yeah, the narrative around relationship building did so much work to sort of justify the program, but also to hide the very insidious consequences of it in this like really nice, story. And there were certainly so many stories about police integrating themselves into the life of the school in all these ways. I've mentioned sports teams, but also running cooking clubs, delivering anti-bullying presentations, which, you know, the irony of that is, you know, I don't even have to state. Yeah, just integrating themselves into the life of the school in so many different ways. So that was some of the biggest work we had to do around pushing back, because there were so many, even teachers and school administrators, even parents, just saying that, you know, like, this policing program is different. It's community policing. It's actually nice. You know, our SRO is a nice guy. So there was a real individualization of a systemic issue by saying like, our guy is actually fine. You know, he does great things in the school. And the police really worked to humanize individual SROs, and cast them in that light, which made it even more difficult to convince policymakers and other educational stakeholders of the damaging impacts of this program. So that was one big way we had to push back. And then another way that we had to really push back was sort of people saying, well, we really actually need this support in schools. We need extra support in schools, because schools are underfunded. We need more caring adults in the building, and the police officer is running all these programs and doing all these great things. And who's going to do that if the officer leaves, right? And that's a bit of an easier one to counter, because really, if we don't have enough caring adults and enough responsible, trained professionals in the building that are there to support students, that's a much bigger issue around austerity and cuts to education and school funding and the resources that schools require, because policing is not the solution to that. And this is actually a lot of what we've had to say more recently as well, as these concerns have risen again in the past couple weeks.
Yeah, I find the narrative around relationship building is one that is certainly, as someone who is like sort of observed this struggle but not directly participated in the move towards pushing SROs out of schools, that's really the one that I've heard the most. And even from people who have worked in schools with police, is kind of the same thing. Like, well, this specific person who occupies the job of police, who is dispatched to be a school resource officer, is an okay person. Like, they're a really nice person. And it is really hard to disrupt that idea of like, that person might be a really nice person and they might like be invested in the students in the schools. And the overall structure is like having this sort of interaction between like discipline, law enforcement, policing, tangled up with like the public school system, where you're supposed to learn and build like, you know, your foundational sense of belonging and community, is like sort of overarchingly damaging. But I can imagine that was like a really difficult narrative to fight.
Yeah, it really, really was. It was hard. But I think bringing to light some of the things that this narrative obscures was the way that we had to approach it. Like, for example, we had many stories of young people. I mean, it's very manipulative. The relationship building narrative is so manipulative. And we had a lot of stories of young people sort of maybe saying something like, telling something about themselves to the police, or information coming out in different ways in clubs or whatever it might be. And then the police using that information and sharing it with other, like, frontline law enforcement, with other community policing officers, with immigration officials as well, to sort of target and arrest or detain or whatever students and their families outside of the school. So it's just there was actually a moment where I was reading a Toronto Police Services report. It was, I believe, one of their 2011 reports that was saying that SROs actually had been officially placed on these tactical intelligence strategy teams, where they collect and share information with other enforcement officers. And one of the arguments that we made was that that actually really contravenes some school board policies. So, for example, the TDSB has a don't ask, don't tell policy that is meant to keep students with precarious immigration status safe at school. And basically that was a push, a really big push from some migrant justice organizations to ensure that if anyone in the school building finds out a young person's immigration status, well, first of all, they're not supposed to ask. So, you know, school officials, administrators, employees are not supposed to ask about student immigration status. And if they find out, they're not supposed to report it, because that could put students and their families in a lot of danger of detention or deportation if their status is precarious. And so having this policy means that we're supposed to be following this policy in schools, but then having SROs who have a mandate to collect and share information about young people with Canada Border Services Agency means that schools are no longer sanctuary schools. They're no longer safe for young people and their families who are in this situation. So we had to really bring to light all of the ways that even though there is this veil of relationship building happening, there are so many insidious things happening under the surface. So a lot of our work was bringing those things to light where they were previously a little more hidden.
Bushfire till you can't breathe. Never gonna stop until you're on your knees. You ain't taking my son, you won't get past me.
Block by block, feel the city rock. Tension, release.
Hey, you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today we're interviewing Geeta, a teacher and activist from Toronto. Geeta is a founding member of the group Education Not Incarceration and joins us to talk about the group's struggle to keep police out of schools.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if, kind of speaking about the interaction between SRO and Don't Ask, Don't Tell policies, and you sort of mentioned these other migrant justice groups. I'm wondering if you could talk about the sort of coalition that was formed and what other groups in the city that have collaborated with Education Not Incarceration.
Yeah, so I think it's important to go back. I mentioned that we sort of revived this older, this movement that had come up right when the program was implemented in 2008. So some of those organizations that had done that work at that time really laid a lot of the groundwork for the resistance. And so it's important to mention those organizations. One is JFAP, so Jane and Finch Action Against Poverty. They've been doing a lot of really, really amazing work for many years. And you can see, you can find videos from back in 2008 where they're interviewing community members in the Jane and Finch community about what they think about the implementation of this program. At the time, there was also an organization called No Cops, which is an acronym for Neighborhood Organized Coalition Opposing Policing in Schools, No Cops, which had brought together a number of folks who were pushing back on this, writing about it, interviewing students, pamphleting outside schools, etc. And other organizations like Educators for Peace and Justice. At the time, there were also school walkouts that had happened, protests, other students who were doing this kind of, you know, engaging in this form of resistance right when SROs were implemented in their schools. So that really set the stage back in 2008. And then when this campaign was revived in 2016, he and I, we did sort of like a lot of work on our own for a bit. But once things started ramping up, we started to be more in conversation with other organizations across the city. So some of those as well that still existed, like JFAP, but other organizations as well, like Black Lives Matter, Toronto, No One Is Illegal, another organization called LAN, some parent organizations, other educator groups. So pretty wide, a wide spread of groups around the city were mobilized and doing this work together. And yeah, I think it allowed for us to tap into a lot of communities, a lot of places that, you know, just having such a broad network of organizations working on this, it'll also allowed us to get even more media attention, public attention. It allowed us to bring a lot of people out to board meetings, to make deputations, to do the lobbying of trustees, et cetera, et cetera. And so in the end, it was a pretty powerful sort of, it wasn't a formalized coalition. It was just a number of organizations kind of coming together with this common purpose, which was really amazing. Of course, there were struggles in that too. There's not always complete alignment on political vision or on strategy and tactics and things like that. So I think you'll always have some internal conflict around those kinds of things within coalition spaces or within movement spaces. But in the end, we were successful in our goal of removing the program. So,
yeah. So can you, I'm just looking at the timeline here so I understand.
Yeah.
So in 2001, we have the Safe Schools Act. Then in 2007, we have this like sudden death shooting in a school, which created this vibe of sort of moral panic and desire to respond. Then in 2008, there was this implementation. There were some groups that pushed against it, but ultimately the program continued. Then in 2017, Education Not Incarceration got the program under review, suspended, and then closed. And then
with a number of other organizations.
Organizations and collaborators. And then can you help me understand the current context? Because the reason I had contacted you for an interview was because I saw in this sort of like abolition listserv that there's this uptick in conversation and dialogue around the SRO program being on the table to return to school. So I wonder if you could contextualize what's happening now in December 2022.
Yes, for sure. So this came up again recently, 5 years later, for a number of reasons. So I just would like to, again, you know, set a bit of context. So one is that the needs in schools are really high right now. So one of the things that's really happening right now is there is an increase in violence in schools. And this is part of what has fueled this new sort of like renewed cycle of media attention to schools and violence in schools. And it's true, there schools have really been struggling recently, particularly in this school year, with an uptick in violence. But I just want to contextualize it in a couple of things. So one is that the pandemic has been really, really, really difficult on young people. So students have faced 3 years of disruptions that have had really significant educational impacts, mental health impacts, emotional, social impacts. Coming back into the school building, there have been a lot of altercations between students, and there's really urgency for greater supports around for, you know, coming out of such a difficult time to be a young person, to be anybody, you know, but to be a young person who's in school. So we really need supports. We really need constructive supports for students in schools. But we're also facing a time of very, very serious cuts to education from the Ford government. So the public education system has been underfunded for quite a long time, but right now it's quite literally being destroyed by cuts. So there are, you know, cuts to things like staffing. First of all, there are not enough teachers and administrators in the building. There's major cuts. There's been a huge labor struggle recently around support workers. The people who keep schools running are our child and youth workers, partners that we bring in from the community, social work, particular kinds of social workers. I know social work can be its own sort of like partial institution as well, but you know, just all of the different relationships that young people can have with adults in the building. Having field trips, having programming opportunities, leadership opportunities, nutrition, school lunch programs, technology, proper technology in classrooms, so even just basic things like supplies, you know, all of this has been cut, and it's leaving schools in very, very dire conditions. And so that's sort of like the context. And when you combine those two things, higher student needs as a result of coming out of the pandemic and all of the struggles that young people are facing right now, with the complete stripping down of any supports in schools, it has created the context for some increased school violence. And that is a reality that we are facing right now. And so that has been a bit more in the media for sure, because, you know, young people are scared to go to school in some cases. Parents are scared, and families are scared about what's happening in schools. And what we learned was that, well, first of all, this has sort of revived the pro-SRO side of things, saying, you know, people saying, look, you all removed SROs from schools 5 years ago, and look what has happened. So there's no actual critical look at why we are in the situation we are in today. It's just sort of like people saying that the reason that this has happened is because we removed police from schools. And so the pro-SRO side is kind of mobilized. They, you know, folks started writing some op-eds. Former police officers have started pushing more for bringing this program back. So that's kind of how it's been put on the table. And then at the same time, school board trustees are under a lot of pressure, and the school board themselves, to do something. So once again, it's sort of a similar situation as in 2007, this really big push from the public to make schools safe and to do something. And so we got word that there would be one or more trustees potentially putting forward a motion to reinstate the program at a school board meeting. And so as soon as we got that word, we mobilized, because we were like, no, the situation that we're in now is not going to be solved by putting police back in schools, like for so many reasons, right? And so we needed to sort of, if this was a possibility of bringing the program back, we needed to mobilize very quickly to let people know that we would, like, this is not going to happen, and this is not the answer to the current crisis that we're currently facing. So a couple of weeks ago, when we heard this was happening, we very quickly brought everyone back together again and started doing the almost very similar work to what we had been doing before. A lot of the school board trustees are new. They don't know the past struggle of what had happened before. So they were asking the same questions. The media doesn't like to have a good, like mainstream media doesn't have great memory, because they were asking all of the same questions again, even though we had this whole debate 5 years ago. You know, I was once again getting calls about, why do you think police should not be in schools, when we have been through this before, you know? So this has been put on the table. And so we did a lot of that mobilizing work again, a lot of that lobbying, talking to trustees, writing op-eds in the paper, doing social media, mobilizing, getting people to write their trustees, all of these kinds of things, trying to shape the public narrative again around why we're in this situation we're in versus, you know, the other side of the narrative, which is, you know, we got here because we removed police from schools. And so what has happened in the past few weeks was that when this came to the trustees and to the school board meeting, there were, once again, many people mobilized and made deputations at this meeting. And the motion was actually never even put forward in the end at the school board meeting. So there was no actual vote to reinstate or not reinstate the program because trustees, no trustee ever put forward the motion. And what we heard sort of on the back end of things was that the motion was not brought forward because of all of the mobilizing that had happened. It wasn't just us. A huge, huge part of this, and actually the one of the big catalysts really have been some young people. And so there have been students from a school called York Memorial that really did some organizing and really brought some attention, big public attention to what has been happening at their school. And they actually have really been leading the way on saying that the answer to the current crisis is not the police. So these students are absolutely amazing. They put out a set of demands. Would you like me to give you just a little bit of background on York Memorial? Okay. So York Memorial is a school that the school building experienced a fire a couple years ago that destroyed a lot of the building. And so that school had to be merged with another school in the area. And at the time, a lot of students sort of made it known to the board their position on the merger, which was that they didn't think it was a good idea for a number of reasons. But the school board went ahead with it anyways, and this merger happened, and the two schools started coexisting in the same building as of this September, so just a couple months ago. There have been so many issues in the school. There have been, you know, lack of staff, lack of a stable administration, all of these issues that I've already been naming. But in a school building that's over capacity, under-resourced, and students have just not, you know, have not been having a great experience. And there have been fights. There have been all sorts of things happening. So recently, a number of teachers refused to come into work because they were saying there are unsafe conditions in the building. But then a number of students also said, There are unsafe conditions in the building, but it's not because of us. It's not because us students are you know, you teachers in the media are painting us in this really, you're criminalizing us. You're saying that the issues in the building are because of us, but they're actually because this school building is not being supported in the way it needs to be. Students are not being supported in the way that we need to be supported. And they were pointing to a lack of opportunities, a lack of space, a lack of, you know, not being able to use the gym because it's full of stuff, and, you know, just not being able to properly have the educational experiences that they deserve. Even things like not having toilet paper in the bathrooms. So really, really just basics. And these students organized a school walkout to bring light to these issues. And they put out a set of demands, which are mostly about greater allocation of resources to the school, greater training for teachers and all educational staff around anti-racism and anti-Black racism in particular. Yeah, and one of their main demands is stop policing us. Stop bringing police into the building. They're not helping this situation, and they're criminalizing young people. We don't need to be police. That's not the answer to what's happening right now. We need more social workers who reflect our communities, who are from our communities. We need more child and youth workers. We need parent counselors who are from our communities, you know? Students are actually asking for all of the things that the research shows is what makes schools actually safe. And so their voices have really been forefronted in this conversation, and they're really leading the way. We're just here to support their demands, really. And it's just amazing to see that their demands are backed by evidence and data as well. So I know that they're going to continue this fight. I think the TDSB is currently responding in a way that feels quite progressive compared to before. You know, some of the recommendations and reports that have come out in recent days are about increased resources, increased caring relationships, disciplinary programs rooted in restorative and transformative justice. You know, sort of like quite a different approach. So I think it just remains to be seen how this will be implemented and whether there will be the political and financial will and resourcing to actually make all of this happen. And the question about the involvement, the ongoing involvement of police in schools is still on the table. There is a police school board protocol that sort of defines when police can be called into schools and what their role is in the schools. But the protocol itself is not a strong governance document. It leaves a lot of things open to interpretation and is quite subjective. So I think there's work to be done on that front. And there's also many examples of police still being called into schools to do presentations and to do sort of like non-enforcement activities. So that's a whole other area, because that also happens in elementary schools. So that's a whole other area that we need to look at. So the relationship between police and schools still requires quite a lot of examination and following. But for now, the SRO program is not on the table.
That's really amazing to hear. And I think it makes a lot of sense what you're saying. Like, there was a really strong basis for this fight, and it sounds like education, not incarceration, along with collaborators and alongside the students from York Memorial, were able to sort of be, they were prepared to bring forward some of the narratives and explanations that you had already experienced and already having some of the data and research, and then also how important it is to hear from students themselves who are saying, like, this is actually not going to solve the problems in our schools. We have really clear requests, which are reflected in research, is really amazing to hear. And it's really cool to hear you talk so fluently about, like, the whole arc of this struggle as it's been going on since the early 2000s.
For sure. Yeah, I got to just give so much love to those young people who are organizing and fighting for their right to an education, the education that they deserve. Yeah. So it's been so inspiring to watch. And just sort of like a quick side note, there was another student walkout at another school called Marc Garneau, not around this issue, but around another issue recently related to how the issue of Palestine is taken up in schools and in the board. And so we're just seeing a rise of students getting together and organizing. And it's absolutely amazing.
That's really awesome to hear, and a very sort of hopeful note, I think, to end. Wrap up this conversation on. Before we close the interview, is there anything that you didn't get a chance to say that, or any question I didn't ask that you just want to respond to?
I can't think of anything in this moment, no.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Geeta. This was like such a comprehensive overview and definitely helped me to understand a lot more about the history of school resource officers and the contradictory narratives surrounding them. And the sort of the current struggle, which is like ongoing and about collaboration between police and schooling. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your involvement with this movement, with the Prison Radio Show.
Absolutely. And thank you so much to you and the whole team for all of your really important work.
Thanks for listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. We just want to take a minute to send holiday wishes to all our listeners, especially those spending the holiday season detained. The Prison Radio Show Collective is wishing you all peace, support, and health during this season as we move towards the new year. We also want to give a shout out to the group Freelands Free People, an anti-colonial penal abolition group out west, fundraising to provide care packages to incarcerated Indigenous people in the prairies. To learn more about their fundraiser or to make a donation, you can simply Google Freelands Free People and you'll find their GoFundMe page. Finally, a reminder that you can be in touch with the Prison Radio Show Collective by giving us a phone call at 438-337-8423. That's 438-337-8423. And you can always send us snail mail to the following address: Prison Radio Show, CKUT 90.3 FM, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, Canada, H3A 2B3. We really love to hear from listeners, and we particularly welcome feedback and pitches or ideas for shows. You're welcome to share any element of your daily life with us. Our next show is January 12th at 5 p.m. and then January 27th at 11 a.m. We hope you'll join us. Until then, take care, be well, and happy holidays from the Prison Radio Show.
Is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
Thank you. afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.